in Detroit, that there's a possibility that Ragnow could still play against the Seahawks on Monday as he played through the injury in week three. Pac-12 Conference is suing the Mountain West Conference. Rays and Tigers right now scoreless in day baseball in the fifth.
Fox Sports update on KPRL, brought to you by Deeds Bar and Grill at the Paso Robles Golf Club. Great food, great view, great people. Prime Rib Monday, Taco Tuesday, and new daily specials. And check out the great new golf shop. Today in Farming on KPRL is brought to you by Paso Robles Glass, established in 1947, always up on the latest technology and training. They do windows right. Call Paso Robles Glass, 805-238-4014.
Welcome to the Line on Agriculture Report. This is Lori Boyer for the Ag Information Network. Yesterday, Crossroads Co-op Regional Manager Brian Irie gave insight into the anticipated interest rate cuts by the end of the year and what that means for the 2024 crop season. In today's report, Irie talks about the effects the interest rates will have on the livestock markets.
You're hearing a little more in terms of heifer retention this year than you did last year. The feeder cattle market has been just an absolute nightmare here over the course of the last couple of months. We are back close to recent highs, but the volatility in that market has made it a little difficult for, I think, both the feedlot operator as well as the rancher to try to make marketing decisions. But the cheaper feed is definitely working in their favor. And I think that's something that's going to be with them for a couple of years here, where they maybe have increased chances for profitability with their operations.
Once again, that was Brian Irie, Crossroads Co-op Regional Manager. As he mentioned yesterday, when it's all said and done, he anticipates a 1.25% interest rate cut by the end of the year, which would be good for both agriculture and the economy as a whole. And of course, that includes consumers.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture has reneged on its promise to let America's cattle ranchers choose the type of animal identification device that best fits their operations. Ranchers can now use low-cost ear tags, or they can use the high-cost electronic identification, or EID, ear tags, giving ranchers the choices of fundamental value we all understand. But the USDA wants a one-size-fits-all system, and beginning November 5th, ranchers will be forced to use high-cost EID ear tags when shipping adult cattle across state lines. This freedom and liberty stripping mandate must be stopped. Congresswoman Harriet Hagman and U.S. Senator Cynthia Lummis, both from Wyoming, have introduced resolutions to overturn this mandate, and they need your help. Please call your members of Congress and urge them to support the resolutions of disapproval that will overturn the USDA's EID mandate. You can reach your members of Congress by calling 202-224-3121 and ask for them by name. This message is brought to you by RCAF USA.
For the Ag Information Network, I'm Lori Boyer.
Today in Farming on KPRL is brought to you by Paso Robles Glass, established in 1947, always up on the latest technology and training. They do windows right. Call Paso Robles Glass, 805-238-4014.
This Fox Business News update on KPRL is brought to you by Stifel, your full-service wealth management firm since 1890. Stifel, located at 1337 Vine Street in Paso Robles. Call 805-238-3080. Stifel, 238-3080.
I'm Charles Payne, and this is the Fox Business Report.
A choppy trading session with stocks mixed in afternoon trading after a reading on consumer confidence fell unexpectedly in September. The Conference Board said its Consumer Confidence Index tumbled this month, falling by the largest level in more than 3 years as Americans' fears grew about the job market and business conditions. Tech stocks are gaining today while financials are lagging and shares of Chinese companies are surging after China's central bank unveiled a host of stimulus measures. Shares of Visa are falling over 4%. The U.S. Justice Department has filed an antitrust lawsuit against the credit card company, alleging that Visa uses its size and dominance to stifle competition in the debit card market. And shares of AutoZone are driving lower after the auto parts retailer reported fourth quarter earnings and sales that did increase, but not enough to meet expectations. That's your Fox Business Report. I'm Hillary Barsky, invested in you.
Need life insurance but have diabetes, high blood pressure, or on anxiety meds? If you're a 50-year-old male, even Porky, or with type 2 diabetes, $1 million of life insurance may only cost you about $200 a month. For affordable term life insurance, call Term Provider and speak with Big Lou at 800-444-2013. 800-444-2013 or visit BigLou.com. Remember, Big Lou's like you. He's on meds too. 800-444-2013.
This Fox Business News update on KPRL brought to you by Stifel, your full-service wealth management firm since 1890. Stifel, located at 1337 Vine Street in Paso Robles. Call 805-238-3080. Stifel, 238-3080. The
judge said, roll out the barrel, and the brewer was faced with a dilemma. I'll be right back.
Reagan, in his own voice, is brought to you by Mills Construction. For architectural, metal, roofing, and siding, call Aaron at 610-1256.
If you made a product that could only be shipped long distances under refrigeration, but refrigeration wasn't always available, thus risking spoilage and the disappointment and even ire of your customers, you might want to restrict the sale of your product to an area where you could be sure it would be delivered in top condition, right? Wrong, said a federal district judge recently, in ruling that the Adolph Coors Company of Colorado could no longer limit the geographical territory in which its beer is distributed. Now keep in mind that beer is a perishable commodity. It has a shelf life of about 3 months before the flavor begins to deteriorate in the bottle and its quality goes downhill. Most brewers mark the shelf life dates of their product in one way or another on six packs and on cases. Some even send their salesmen around to the stores to remove outdated beer from time to time, to make sure the customers get what they're paying for, fresh beer. The Coors people told the court that they had a special problem. It seems theirs is the only beer in America that is unpasteurized. It's made by the so-called aseptic process. This gives it a particular flavor. The trouble is that the unpasteurized product must be transported only under refrigeration, or it'll begin to deteriorate well before the normal shelf life limit. To complicate the problem, Coors has only one brewery, and it's in the Rocky Mountains. They claim that refrigerated transportation isn't always available for hauling their beer nearly 2,000 miles to the East Coast. So for many years, they've restricted themselves to being a regional brand, selling only in 11 western states where they felt they could be sure of delivering their product under the proper conditions. Thirsty Easterners, meanwhile, were paying about four times as much as Westerners for the occasional deliveries of the brewery's suds that somehow found their way eastward. The judge was unmoved by the brewery's argument. His ruling was that the Coors firm was engaged in what were called illegal, anti-competitive business practices. Now that's a little odd when you consider that this firm is operating in a highly competitive field in which all the competing companies clamor vigorously for the public's attention and its favor. In fact, it's precisely because they have been successfully competitive that Coors has risen to become the nation's fourth largest brewer, even though it's regional rather than national in scope. Presumably, the court case will be appealed, so the final outcome can't be predicted. Meanwhile, those thirsty Easterners may get that Rocky Mountain brew they've been wanting, but will the brewer be able to deliver it in the condition in which they'll want to drink it? You know, the judge didn't offer any suggestions about that. This is Ronald Reagan. Thanks for listening.
Reagan, in his own voice, brought to you by Mills Construction, specializing in pre-engineered metal buildings. Call Aaron at 610-1256.
Protecting what matters on the right choice, AM 1230 KPRL 99.3 FM with Barry Fisher. Advice and information on protecting what matters most in today's world. brought to you by Adler Belmont Insurance Brokers and their new associate, Heather Bordan, serving the commercial insurance needs of businesses on the Central Coast.
It's Tuesday, and it's 12:30, and it's time for Protecting What Matters. PWM is the broadcast that helps you become better shoppers and buyers of services and products to protect various aspects of your life, health, and property. We also explore current events, our history, community, institutions, and local treasures that are notable and worth preserving. Our guests and topics today, our first guest up is Susan Shelley. She is the Vice President of Communications for the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association. We're going to be focusing on Proposition 5 and a number of other tax and spend initiatives that are on the ballot. We're going to talk about the history of Prop 13. This is very important. So many people today don't even remember what Prop 13 is all about, so we're going to start with that, why it's important to stop Prop 5, which is the latest effort to gut Prop 13, and other ballot initiatives. Susan, welcome to Protecting What Matters.
Thank you very much. Very great to be with you.
Great. We're happy to have you. And at the 1 o'clock hour, we have Jenny Grinninger. She is a trustee of the Templeton Unified School District. We're going to talk about why and how cell phone regulations at our public schools are good for our kids, educational proficiency in our schools, and social-emotional learning and other bad ideas that hurt our schools and students. You can call in with questions or comments, 805-238-5775, 238-KPRL. Before we start with Susan here, I just want to give a shout-out to Andrea Seastrand, who, of course, is with the Central Coast, runs the Central Coast Taxpayers Association. When I asked her to come on the show, she said, you want to get Susan Shelley on from the Howard Jarvis Association. So, Susan, again, thanks for taking some time with us today. You've got quite a career here. Aside from all your efforts with Howard Jarvis Association, Taxpayers Association, you're a columnist and an editorial board member for the other to newspaper in Los Angeles, the LA Daily News.
Yes.
And tell us a little bit about that work and what you're doing there.
Well, that's the Southern California News Group. It's 11 papers, including the Los Angeles Daily News, the Orange County Register, the Riverside Press Enterprise. There are 11 papers altogether in the group. And I'm on the editorial board, so we look at different issues. We look at different candidates. We look at ballot measures. And where they don't conflict with my work at Howard Jarvis, I participate in the decisions about what we endorse and what we don't endorse. And it's very interesting work to have the opportunity to talk to elected officials and candidates and sometimes to public officials and say, what are you thinking? Because somebody really should ask them that from time to time. that's helpful.
No kidding. And, you know, really, The LA Daily News and the other newspapers you mentioned as well really give a balance to what really should be called the Los Angeles Times, right? I mean, they are just on they're just on one side all the time.
Pretty much, yes.
Yeah. And you actually ran for state assembly a few years back. How long ago was that?
That was in 2013 in a special election, and that was extremely close. It went to a recount, and then I ran in the regular cycle in 2014 and did very well, but did not get elected, but it showed that taxpayers who are Democrats or Republicans care very much about Proposition 13. Nobody wants to be taxed out of their house, and regardless of anyone's political beliefs on other issues, when it comes to being a taxpayer, everybody's on the same side.
So let's take a little bit of time here to explain to the audience and give them a little history on Prop 13, because you've got a lot of really great information on your website about this, but it really was quite a battle back in the 70s to get Prop 13 passed. So why don't you unpack that a little bit?
Okay, well, to give you the context of it, it used to be the case that property in California was taxed based on its market value every year. And the tax rate was different in different areas. It was in some places as high as 3%, in some places 1%, statewide average 2.67%. Now, I want you to stop for just a minute. Don't do this if you're driving, don't listen, and if you have a pacemaker, turn off the radio. Not really. But here's the situation. Imagine paying 2.67% of the market value of your property every year as a condition of keeping it. Because that's how they used to do property taxes. And as inflation pushed up the prices every year, people were being taxed out of their houses. And Howard Jarvis tried five times to get this property tax limitation on the ballot. Finally succeeded in 1978. It was on the ballot in the June primary, and it was Proposition 13. The whole government of California and every major lobbying group was against it, but it prevailed with, I think it was 65% of the vote, almost two-thirds. And what it did is it said that as long as you owned your property, the assessed value could not go up more than 2% a year, regardless of what the market did, regardless of what how the market could go up 20%, as it was in some years, and your assessed value would go up no more than 2% with inflation. And the tax rate was cut to 1% statewide. And that has allowed Californians to keep their property, which is very important. Because if someone can tax you out of your property just because they want to, just because they can get a majority vote to tax you out of your property, that is your freedom, that's your liberty, that's your security. You are not free. You are not living in a free country if the government can just randomly, arbitrarily raise taxes and tax you out of your property. So Prop 13 also included limitations on raising other taxes, because Howard Jarvis knew that if you limited property taxes, they'd come at you some other way. And that's what we fight today to protect, the right to vote on taxes at the local level, the two-thirds vote requirement in the state legislature to pass a tax increase statewide. We fight for these important taxpayer protections to make sure that people are not taxed out of this state.
Did taxes ever go down? I mean, if the market values go down at the time before Prop 13, did the taxes go down?
They would have, and they still do, because another proposition, Proposition 8, a couple of years later, said that if the value of the property declines, you can get a decline in value reassessment. So you have protection on the downside, and you have protection on the upside, and that's very important. But when you get a decline in value reassessment, it doesn't stay there if the market goes up again. And some people have had a rude surprise because the assessors can raise your assessment back to what it would have been under Prop 13 if it hadn't had the decline. They can do that in one jump. And sometimes people have a bad experience with that because it's rather stunning. But it means that the market recovered and now you're back where you were under Prop 13.
It sounds almost like the efforts that some people, you know, on the left want to do is to tax unrealized capital gains on the value of your house up and down as it goes. And you know, that's happening in Congress. It's happening up in Sacramento. Hopefully it's an idea that never will happen. But I mean, again, it's all about tax predictability, really. People being
exactly.
And you were mentioning to me when we spoke last week that, I mean, controls on taxing the citizens of California is well established within our state constitution going back to the 1850s, right?
Yes. As a matter of fact, in the original 1849 Constitution of California, which was handwritten on parchment in the Gold Rush era, the legislature was directed to restrict the ability of cities, municipal corporations, they called it, to contract debt, to borrow money, to loan their credit, to essentially put the people of the area in the red for years or decades to come. The legislature was directed to restrict that ability in order to prevent abuses. And in 1879, that was formalized so that local governments could not borrow money, which they do by issuing bonds, as you know. They could not issue bonds without a two-thirds vote of the electorate, of the people of the area. And since 1879, that protection has been in the Constitution.
Susan, we have a caller. What's your question? Thanks for calling.
Hey, no, I just had a comment. When property taxes were instituted in California in 1934, they had an exemption for owner-occupied residences. And that is the same $7,000 exemption you see today. But in 1934, $7,000 was approximately twice the value of the average single-family residence. So the intent was that you could have your house, or you could have maybe a really nice house compared to your neighbor, and not pay any property taxes. If your house was worth over $7,000, you paid taxes on the amount over $7,000. That $7,000 was never adjusted for inflation. If it were, that the property tax exemption would be about $1.2 million, or about double the price of a modest home. So the single-family homeowners under the original property tax bill were never intended to pay any property tax.
Well, thanks.
Well, you're exactly right. You're exactly right about that. It's called the homeowner's exemption. It has never been raised. It is still $7,000 off the assessed value of your home, which saves you $70 a year, which is nice, but nothing to write home about. And you're exactly right that if the legislature had wanted to in the 1970s, they could have increased the homeowner's exemption, and they could have taken the steam out of Prop 13, but they didn't want to do that. They wanted the money. They believed that Howard Jarvis would never be able to get this on the ballot, and the people would not vote for it, and they were wrong. And it remains today one of the most popular taxpayer protections anywhere in the country. It is iconic because in other states, this just happened in Chicago, there was an apartment building owner who was reassessed in one swoop from about $28,000 a year in property taxes to $123,000 in property taxes. And he had to raise the rent, he said, up to $5,000 a month for one-bedroom apartments in this building. And he said, no one's going to be able to pay that, but what am I supposed to do? And he was trying to appeal his reassessment to the assessor. In California, we don't have that problem because we have Proposition 13. So you never get that unwelcome surprise that your property tax bill has quintupled because the market value of your home, which you can't control, has gone up. You're never taxed on paper profits.
Thanks for your call. You know, you bring up a really good point, and I want to get into Prop 5 here because this is all great information, and I'm glad we're doing this background. But you mentioned something very important, Susan. If you're renting and you don't think rising property taxes don't impact you, think again, because having been a landlord in the past, when expenses go up for the landlord, they're going to get passed on to the consumer and their renters. It's in some way, shape, or form, either in the form of higher rents or maybe deferred maintenance on the property. So, Susan, Prop 5, you know, this has kind of had a circuitous route through the legislature. It was ACA 1, and they tried to do several different things with it, and they ended up scaling it back, but it still has some real dangers to California taxpayers. Let's take the last part of this segment, as much as we have here left, but we got about 6 or 7 minutes, really unpacking what Prop 5 would do if it's passed. And obviously, we want a no vote on Prop 5 from our listeners, correct?
Correct. No on Prop 5, the most dangerous, expensive thing on your statewide ballot. So what it does is it makes it easier to raise property taxes. The protection of the two-thirds vote to take on more debt at the local level, which has been in the Constitution since 1879, would be tossed out and replaced with a 55% vote to raise local property taxes, because local bonds are repaid with charges on your property tax bill. And once again, if you don't pay your property tax bill, the county will sell your house out from under you. So what we're at risk of here is having property taxes go up after every election because they're making it easier to take on debt. And that is going to create abuses, as the 1849 Constitution warned. Every election, there will be, one year it could be a transit bailout, and then it could be, oh, we need the money for fire stations. Well, what did you do with the money we already paid for fire services? What did you do with the taxes we've already paid? Never mind, we're going to borrow money for fire stations because that's what people will vote for. If we said it was for pay raises, they wouldn't vote for it. So we're going to use the money we have for pay raises, and we're going to borrow money for fire stations. You're going to see this on every ballot. Twice, once in the primary, once in the general, and your taxes will go up as these things pass after every election. This is so dangerous. This is a turbo engine to raise property taxes. And as you mentioned, it originally was also going to apply to all taxes, not just property taxes. They were going to cut the threshold for passing sales taxes and parcel taxes and hotel taxes down to 55%. But that was polling very badly. So the legislature raced in, and they passed ACA 10 to amend ACA 1. And so what is on your November ballot only would make it easier to borrow money, not to raise other taxes, so it's just property taxes that are affected. But as you mentioned, everybody ends up paying property taxes because not only do renters see it in higher rent, but consumers see it in higher prices because commercial property is taxed also. So if the smallest little donut shop is going to get this property tax increase passed through by it, by the landlord of the strip mall or wherever it is, that property tax bill is passed through on a commercial lease. That's a standard provision. So everybody will pay higher prices, higher rents, the higher cost of housing, the higher cost of living. This is the wrong approach. And it incentivizes reckless, abusive behavior by local governments because it's making it easier to borrow money and raise taxes.
And, of course, the subterfuge is always in because, the mayor of Berkeley wrote something in Cal Matters, an article in Cal Matters, and, you know, he focused on the notion that this is going to help local governments build more homes and infrastructure, and because it'll make it easier for them to tax the citizens and the property owners. My question always is, there's so many other ways to build homes and infrastructures, like reducing regulations and making it easier, not having to pay prevailing wage all the time, that runs up the cost of building anything in the state of California. Why do we continually get fooled by these nicely titled propositions on the ballot?
It's because I think it's a lot to do with how these things are reported in the press and explained by the politicians. What they do is they sort of do a scoping mechanism where they don't want to talk about anything except these little narrow things. So they don't want to talk about what caused the problem or all the other solutions that there are to the problem. They just want to say, well, if we don't raise taxes, what are we supposed to do? And then they hang up on you. So that's kind of how they do it. And they leave people not understanding why we're in this situation. And you raise an important point about the cost of building in California. Another thing affecting housing prices is that we have effectively an urban boundary that city governments have put around their cities for environmental reasons, because they think it's bad for the climate if people drive to work from an outlying area. If the jobs are in the city and the houses are in the suburbs, they think that's bad. They want everyone to live in apartments on top of train tracks in a downtown area. Well, that is not really working out very well, despite decades of trying to make it work. So why are we artificially restricting where we can build new suburbs and new communities? It has no effect on the climate. It's just for show. It certainly does not. All of California is 1% of greenhouse gas emissions globally. So even if we shut down the state, it wouldn't affect the climate. So certainly restricting how far people can drive to work does not affect the climate. So why are we doing this? We're not building houses where we could build houses because of laws on the books in California and city ordinances and city planning documents that restrict where we're building. And that's just not necessary.
Where are the polls on this right now, Susan? Is there any polling, credible polling out there yet on Prop 5?
The polling that I have seen has it underwater. 49% support, 50% opposition, according to the PPIC poll, I believe.
And is this a simple majority it has to pass, or is it the super majority still?
It's a simple majority.
Really?
To amend the Constitution, yes, to amend the Constitution in California, there are two ways to get the amendment on the ballot. This is a legislative constitutional amendment, so it required a two-thirds vote in the Senate and the Assembly. But once on the ballot, it only needs a simple majority.
So we really need to kill this thing off in a big way.
Yes.
Okay.
We absolutely do. Because if we don't, we're going to have tax increases on the ballot every election forever.
Yes. And there's no accountability really from most of our local and state local or municipalities. I mean, they put these things on the ballot, they expect them to come on up. So anyway, so listen, we've got to take a break here, so I'm going to put you on hold, Susan, and then in the last segment, I want to go do a lightning round of these other really bad money propositions, but tax that are going to raise our taxes even more that are on the ballot. So stay tuned, folks. We'll be back with Susan Shelley of the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association.
The customer service and workmanship at Davis Body Shop is first rate.
Jessica, who is a North County resident, talks about her experience at Davis Body Shop.
Lori, Eric, and Patrick were super helpful. Patrick did a great job ensuring that everything my car needed was done in an incredibly fast time. My car looks amazing inside and out. For body work and customer care, Davis is the best, and we would never take our cars anywhere else.
Davis Body Shop has repaired well over 80,000 vehicles since 1962, and today Davis is the longest established shop on the Central Coast. If you ever need the services of Davis Body Shop, remember, they are San Luis Obispo County's most honored, respected, and trusted auto collision specialist with two locations, on El Camino Real with a convenient enterprise car rental facility, and Davis Body Shop on Theater Drive at Paso Chevrolet.
As the markets have their ups and downs, real estate remains one of the most stable assets in everyone's portfolio. Hi, this is Cindy Mims, owner broker of Colony Mortgage, voted best mortgage company in North County 3 years running. We offer conventional FHA, VA, and reverse mortgages and 100% purchase loans for first-time home buyers. Are you a builder and tired of the red tape when dealing with banks and expensive hard money loans? I have a great new option. Or are you 62 years or older? You can possibly eliminate your monthly mortgage payment and get cash in your pocket. At Colony Mortgage, we have hometown service with competitive rates. We have years of experience with creative financing to find that right loan for you. If it's credit issues stopping you, let us help. We move from our 20-year Atascadero location and now offer two convenient locations to meet personally in Atascadero and Paso Robles. Call 805-466-3598. Thank you for supporting your local businesses.
We're back with Protecting What Matters and Susan Shelley, Vice President of Communications for the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association. Call in with questions or comments, 805-238-5775, 238-KPRL. So we have several other, let's just call them stinkers on the November ballot, Susan, that of course, are all no votes, from our position point of view. But let's go through them. And again, I mean, this is, again, these are other ways. They're bond initiatives. Two of them are bond initiatives, really. Let's talk about Proposition 2, which is money for school facilities and repairs. Tell us about that one.
Well, Proposition 2 is $10 billion of debt for school facilities, and nobody gets the money unless they do a local match. And the local match means that your district will have to put local bonds on the ballot, which will raise your property taxes. So even though it looks like it's all going to go for schools, actually it's going to be giant tax increases. And typically what happens with these is the larger, wealthier school districts are able to hire enough attorneys and consultants to get their applications in, and these grants are awarded first come, first serve. And then the districts that really need their roofs repaired and their facilities upgraded for safety reasons, they don't get anything because the wealthier school districts jumped in and got the money first. So it's not well drafted. It's not a good bond measure. It will end up in local property tax increases. It's too much debt. No on Prop 2.
And so, again, is this a simple majority proposition?
Yes, it is. Same story. It needed a two-thirds vote in the legislature, simple majority on the ballot.
What's the poll? Do we have any polling on this one yet?
I believe the PPIC poll had this one slightly ahead.
You know, interestingly enough, I mean, they're going for school facility repairs. Now, I get it. Okay, I get all that stuff. But based on what we're hearing here is that, school enrollments are down. The school districts are struggling financially. We have one right here in Paso Robles that's having problems. They're closing schools. So, again, I mean, this is just another way to tax the taxpayers. It's something we need to vote no on. So what about,
exactly? But ahead, the legislature can fund this in the budget, and they could have during the period of the giant surplus of $100 billion. They could have paid for everything in this, but they would rather not do that and then come to you for tax increases.
Yep, absolutely. Okay, the next one is again a no vote on Proposition 4, which of one of my favorite topics, and we cover this topic all the time on Protecting What Matters, a climate bond to fund to fund what, windmills out 20 miles out inside of the ocean?
As a matter of fact, $475 million in there for the offshore wind project, which there's no plan and there's no approval of a plan, and it's in international waters and would need federal approval anyway, but that doesn't mean they can't start borrowing money and paying interest on it with your dollars. The only thing worse than reckless spending is reckless spending on a credit card. And that's what this is. It's a lot of programs. It's a lot of grants to different organizations to spend money. There's no real oversight once those grants are made. We don't really know whether that money is spent effectively or all on salaries. And so it's really badly drawn. It's badly written. And it's another $10 billion, which will be $18 billion, including interest, 30 or 40 years. I forget the exact number. This one's the two of them together will take $900 million a year in debt service payments, interest and principal, just to pay it off. We're already paying for old debt nearly $8 billion in interest and principal before we can spend the first dollar on current needs. So the idea of spending bond money on something that's not going to still be there in 30 years, like these programs, like pop-up tents at farmers markets and van pool vehicles for agricultural workers. Imagine doing that on a 40-year loan. That's crazy. That's what this measure is. So no on Prop 4.
This sounds like another train to nowhere bond, really. I mean, when it comes right down to it. The money's just going to the consultants and the industrial complex behind all this climate stuff.
Exactly. And the bond underwriters get a percentage, so they make money, and the investors make money on the interest, and everybody does well except the taxpayers, so no.
So here's another one that the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association is on, and I'm curious to know why, and it's kind of interesting. It's Proposition 6. Again, you're asking for a no vote on this. This would remove involuntary servitude as punishment for crime amendment. What the heck is this all about? And what's the
this was sold to the legislators as an anti-slavery measure. By just changing the Constitution, we're taking out this old language against indentured servitude. But in practice, what this does is remove the ability of prisons and jails to require inmates to work. Right now, about a third of prison inmates at the state level work on jobs that are in the prisons, laundry, cleaning, cooking, landscaping, jobs that are in the prison to keep the facilities running. Well, if they can't be required to work, then they have to be incentivized to work with higher wages. Or somebody's got to come in from the outside and do that work. And either way, it's bad for the taxpayers. And what's the reason for it? Are they arguing that people who are required to work as part of their sentence are enslaved? That is what they're arguing, but that's kind of preposterous to go tell the taxpayers, well, you have to work and you have to pay taxes and they don't have to work because they're very busy taking classes because we want to rehabilitate them, and classes are rehabilitation, but somehow work is not. It makes no sense. It could also lead, according to the Senate Appropriations Committee analysis, to a lot of litigation and potentially court rulings that say prisoners have to be paid minimum wage, and then they're subject to all the workplace regulations, and the taxpayers have to cover the payroll taxes, and it could cost billions of dollars. That's from the Senate Appropriations Committee. That's not me saying that. So it could be very expensive. There will be litigation about it. It throws out all of the older court decisions on these issues because we're amending the Constitution and taking out the language that was there before. So no on Prop 6. It's really it's really kind of a bait and switch.
No kidding. And we'll probably end up having to pay minimum wage to these guys, and or a prevailing wage even in the prisons. Real quick, we have a caller on the line, and we're up against the top of the hour, so make your question really quick.
I'll make it very quick. I might have missed it, but the more I read about Crop 33 and 34, the more I don't understand it. What does she recommend as far as voting for those propositions?
Vote no on 33 because it enables radical rent control, which will crush the housing industry. No on 33. That's the third time it's been on the ballot, by the way. No both times from the voters, and no again on 33. 34 would stop the organization that spends the money on those rent control measures from spending the money on the rent control measures because it's actually a nonprofit. So we're yes on 34 at Howard Jarvis. So no on 33 and yes on 34.
All right. Thanks for the call. Susan, thanks for being on the show. We'll have you back again. And go to the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association website for more information. Susan, thank you so much.
AM 1230 KPRL, 99.3 FM, KPRL.com, Paso Robles, Atascadero, Templeton.
It's 1 o'clock.